to this month's NDCN lunchtime seminar. Great pleasure to welcome Anke Ehlers here, who's professor of psychology down in experimental psychology here. I'll just tell you a little bit about her. So she trained in did her degrees in psychology in Kiel and Tübingen, and then did her PhD thesis in Tübingen. Then spent some time in the States at Stanford, and then went back to Germany. And in 1991, she was made a full professor in Göttingen in Germany. And then in 2 years later, came over to Oxford to experimental psychology as a Wellcome Trust principal research fellow. Oxford didn't manage to keep her and her husband, who is David Clark, for about 10-12 years, and then they went down to London to the Institute of Psychiatry, spent 12 years there, and then in 2012 came back to Oxford to set up this Centre for Anxiety Disorders and Trauma. She's a fellow of the British Academy and the Academy of Medical Sciences. And a couple of years ago, she won the German Prize of Psychology. So she's going to tell you all about what she's done, but she and David Clark have really revolutionized the way that we treat these disorders, particularly, as you'll hear about, with behavioral therapy, and has not only sort of done all the research, but actually been instrumental in getting it into the NHS. So they are responsible for the whole system that we have around the country for these therapies, psychological therapies being developed and used in general practice and by psychologists all around the country. So they're responsible for a huge part of this important aspect of health services. So Anke, thank you very much for coming. Look forward to hearing the talk.
Well, thank you very much, Chris, for the invitation, also for your kind introduction. I'm going to talk about one of our research areas that has kept us very interested for many years now, post-traumatic stress disorder. And you may have already heard about this disorder, but I'll just run through a few characteristics to illustrate what this problem is. First of all, post-traumatic stress disorder is a psychological problem that people develop in response to an event. And it is a traumatic event. It's usually an event that's extraordinary threatening. In everyday language, we sometimes use traumatic for events like losing one's job or going through a divorce. In the scientific literature, it's defined much more narrowly as events that usually involve the threat to one's own life or the life of other people and are extraordinarily frightening. So in my further talk, I will concentrate on this more narrow view of what a traumatic event is. And as we're going to talk a lot about memories of these traumatic events, please bear that in mind. We're talking really about very unusually threatening events. If people have been through one of these events, such an assault or being in a severe accident, being in a war zone or in a natural disaster, they will develop a characteristic group of symptoms we call re-experiencing symptoms. These are usually very vivid memories of the event that come into mind even when the people don't want to think about the event. It can also include nightmares and also include physical reactions that resemble those in the trauma without the patient actually being aware that it's a response to a memory. And that's something I'll come back to later on because that's relevant for treatment. If you have lots of unpleasant memories of a horrible event popping into your mind, it's very understandable that people then start avoiding anything that might remind them of the event, and this can become quite extreme. Some of our patients are completely housebound, for instance. Let's say they were assaulted, and they believe that if they leave their house, there's a high chance of being assaulted again, and then they become housebound. A further group of symptoms really resembles more symptoms of depression. They often called numbing symptoms. People feel they can't really have any emotions any longer. They feel dead inside. but it can also include in the new diagnostic system, it's slightly renamed into negative changes in cognitions and mood. It can involve, for instance, a negative view of the future. I have no future, there's no point in planning for the future because I'm going to be assaulted again, for instance. It sounds a little bit like kind of contradiction, but at the same time, people can also have many, many symptoms of hyperarousal. They can't sleep, they can't concentrate, they're very easily startled. And the numbing and hyperarousal symptoms can be present in the same person at different times. Post-traumatic stress disorder is a distressing condition, and if people do not get better, lots of secondary problems can develop, for instance, depression, substance abuse and later dependency is a common complication, but also more social difficulties or problems in relationships. Many people report that they are very irritable all the time and then their partner responds to that and it can lead to a breakup of relationships, or they can't concentrate and so they can't work and they lose their jobs. One main result from the epidemiological literature on post-traumatic stress disorder that has influenced our thinking about the disorder a lot is illustrated on this slide from a large-scale study by Kessler et al., who interviewed a large number of people in America and identified those who had traumatic events and then determined whether they had PTSD afterwards. And this is a plot just plotting the probability of people having PTSD in the long term if they had PTSD soon after their event. And as you can see, there's quite a steep recovery curve, a natural recovery curve in the initial months after the trauma, usually in the first 12 to 18 months, up to 50% will recover on their own without any treatment. So just through natural recovery, possibly through social support, we don't know exactly what all the active ingredients are, but this is really very important to bear in mind when we're talking about developing treatments for this disorder, because those people who will get better on their own don't need professional help, and we should concentrate our efforts on those people who do not get better on their own. So when we started thinking about post-traumatic stress disorder from a psychological and more precisely cognitive psychology perspective, we asked ourselves the question, can we identify maintaining factors that keep the PTSD going and those that do not recover? And another important consideration was why do people with post-traumatic stress disorder have so many symptoms of anxiety? We talked about avoidance, excessive startle responses, hypervigilance is another symptom. So usually if we think about anxiety from a cognitive perspective, we conceptualize it as something, a fear of something in the future, like I'm afraid I will fail my exam, or I'm afraid I will lose my job. But in PTSD, the problem is really a memory of a past event. So how do these two go together? How do they make sense psychologically? And the idea that David Clark and I proposed in 2000 was that actually what happens is that people with chronic PTSD process the trauma in a way that really leads them to perceive a continuous, a serious current threat. And this threat has two sources. One is characteristics of the trauma memory, and I will focus on those in my talk today. But the other important source of the current threat, I mentioned briefly here, and in treatment we also focus a lot on this. People with PTSD seem to interpret what happened to them in the trauma and the aftermath of the trauma in a way that goes beyond what other people find horrific about the event. So if you are assaulted or have a severe accident or were in a tsunami in Southeast Asia, everybody would have been scared for their lives. They would have found it a horrific experience. But people with PTSD somehow add meanings to that other people wouldn't. And see, this is something that's threatening in the present. It's not just the memory from the trauma that gives you this interpretation. So these negative appraisals are very important for us to bear in mind when we treat PTSD. And then certainly you could ask yourself, well, even if the trauma is long time ago, why do the characteristics of the trauma memory not change, and why do these appraisals not change? Like the man who thought he was a bad father, he will have had lots of other experiences afterwards where he played with his child and had nice interaction with his child, which could have given him evidence that he wasn't a bad father. So there, another part of the model comes in, that people with PTSD use lots of strategies to control the threat that maintain the memory problems and the appraisals. And I'll illustrate that actually on this slide, which is just a graphic representation of the same idea. So at the center of the model, we have people perceiving a current threat, which then is accompanied by intrusive memories, high arousal, and strong emotions, such as feeling afraid, anxious, or guilty, or ashamed, or angry. And one of the sources is the negative appraisals, and the other source, the nature of the trauma memory. That means that if matching triggers are present, they have these re-experiencing symptoms and perceive a current threat. And that you see here the box representing strategies intended to control the threat and the symptoms. And the reason why I'm showing it on this slide is that there are several ways by which these strategies can maintain the PTSD. One is some things people do, which kind of makes perfect sense, but have the consequence that they actually make the symptoms worse. One example is in psychology, it's well known that if you try really hard to push thoughts away, they actually paradoxically pop into your mind more. It was originally shown by Wegener, a social psychologist who had asked people not to think of a white bear. And these white bear experiments all showed, well, if the harder you try, the more you have to think about a white bear. And so that happens in PTSD as well. Obviously, the patients don't want to think about these intrusive memories. They try to push them out of their mind, but then they come back and they try even harder. So it's a kind of vicious circle between the attempts to push them out of their mind and the intrusions or intrusive memories popping back. Another example are excessive precautions, and they work in a different way. So people with PTSD will often be very, very afraid that another trauma may happen, and they then go to excessive measures to keep themselves safe, which help a bit. They make them feel a bit better, but they keep the problem going because they mean that they are now convinced that if they didn't take all these precautions, the new trauma was very likely to happen. So people might only go to bed with a knife next to their bed if they were assaulted, or always leave the light on so that they could spot an intruder early, and so on. And finally, we call these safety behaviors. So in treatment, we would work with patients to basically try out dropping these behaviors and see what happens, to kind of as a behavioral test experiment. And a third example of how these strategies that people use to control their perceived threat maintains PTSD is avoidance. Avoidance thinking about the trauma, avoidance of confronting reminders of the trauma prevents a change of the nature of the trauma memory. And this is something I want to go into a bit more greater detail. So I thought I focus this talk a bit about on the re-experiencing symptoms in PTSD, because that's such a characteristic symptom, really the symptom that is typical for PTSD, and describe those symptoms a bit more to you, and then take you through our line of thinking and the experiments we've done and the data we've collected to test these ideas. So what are the key features of these re-experiencing symptoms in PTSD? First of all, it is quite striking that they are really very easily triggered by a wide range of stimuli. And patients will come and tell you, there's nowhere where I'm safe from these memories. They can come at any time, even if I'm really happy and I just thought I get not thinking about the trauma at all. And what we found through basically lots of interviews with patients and treating patients is that this discrepancy between the patients telling you there's lots of situations that trigger the memories and them often not being able to predict in what situations these appear, is that the triggers are often very subtle sensory cues that overlap with what happened in the trauma. And there's often no meaningful association. It can be similarities, just like the same color or the same pitch of a tone or the same smell. And they are very hard to spot, and so in treatment, that's actually one of the things we work with the patients on. And the interesting thing is that the whole situation can be completely different, but if there's this one match, then they will have fewer experiencing symptoms. The other quality that is very interesting, and from a psychological point of view, is that these intrusive memories have a kind of flashback quality. What we mean with that is that when people have these memories, they are not fully aware that they are responding to memory. It is as if they are back in the situation and as if it was happening right here and then. And this is really striking, and in the clinic we sometimes see it happening in the session, and it is very striking because people completely lose awareness that they are with you as a therapist in the room, and they're back in the trauma, and they are acting exactly like they acted in the trauma. It's quite striking symptom. Often it's not as that extreme. Often it's more like a little moment when they have this, like the gentleman who saw had the flashback of his headlights coming towards him. It's a moment where they really get absorbed into this memory and it feels as if it's happening now. They will feel their life is in danger, but then they can re-engage with the situation they are in. But very distressing nevertheless. And what we also think is important is while people have these intrusive memories, they really are not aware of the current context. At the moment when people have these intrusive memories or these flashback-like memories, they don't take into account the context, oh, this is the vase, and the vase is not in the hospital, but it is in a safe, pleasant place. Okay, so this is more the phenomenology, what we have observed over the years. So what can we hypothesize psychologically could contribute to these features? The first aspect we have been interested in, as just one example, is perceptual priming. That's a very basic psychological process. That means that if you have seen or heard an object or a sound before, then you're better at identifying the same, let's stick with the visual domain, the same picture. You've seen a picture of a tree, then you will be more likely to identify this picture of this tree if it's shown in a degraded way than a control picture. And the other mechanism we were interested in is that obviously in trauma people have very strong emotions, and these emotions could be by Pavlovian conditioning be associated with cues in the traumatic situation. But people may differ in the basically generalization of these learned associations. So if you had like a very specific association to the surgeon's coat, let's take that example, then you would only get anxious when you see the surgeon's coat. But maybe in PTSD people tend to generalize so much that anything with that color or anything that looks vaguely similar would evoke the same emotional responses. And the consequence of both of these learning mechanisms would be that for patients with strong priming or strong generalization, they would find it quite hard to discriminate between the reminders and the original trauma cues. So poor discrimination of the dangerous stimulus with the safe stimulus now, you could say. Let me just take you an example, to one example of one of these primary experiments we did. In this experiment, this is a study done with volunteers who haven't had PTSD. So people basically see picture stories on a computer screen that are made up of pictures, and like there's a running commentary that takes you through. So here's a story about a girl who goes swimming with her dad, and in the evening she's happy and goes to bed. So that's kind of a neutral, mildly positive story. And then there's a traumatic story, like this: another child goes on a driving in the car with her dad, and then there's an accident and the child dies. And what's now of interest is that we, in between the pictures, of the picture stories, we interspersed unrelated objects, briefly flashed up on the screen, that didn't have anything to do with the story. And people were just told they didn't need to pay any attention to those, they were just kind of popping up and they should concentrate on the story. But these were the ones we were interested in, because they would basically not meaningfully related, but would possibly resemble our triggers of trauma memories later. So what we did then is we did a priming test, where we would show people blurred versions of these pictures of the objects they had seen before in both the neutral and the trauma stories, and this was all counterbalanced, of course, and other objects they hadn't seen before. And then you can calculate the difference between the objects they'd seen before and the ones they hadn't seen before. And we were interested to see whether, if an object occurred in a trauma story, it would lead to greater priming, as we had expected. And that was the case. We've replicated that quite a few times. So if a neutral object occurs in a trauma, in the context of a trauma story, even if it's not, it's in itself traumatic, it will elicit stronger priming. So people will basically identify it more easily than if it occurred in a neutral story. Of course, there is a priming effect for the objects in neutral stories as well, but it's bigger in the trauma stories. And importantly, in line with our idea that this could contribute to triggering of intrusions, the enhanced priming, so the difference between this and these conditions, predicted intrusions at 2 weeks. Obviously, an analog experiment, so there's lots of things one can see. Is that real? Did people really have true intrusive memories? But it's one piece of evidence in line with this hypothesis. To the other example, the generalization of fear responses. This is now a study that we did with people who attended an accident and emergency department in South London, and they either had experienced a road traffic accident, or they had experienced an assault. And they were shown various groups of pictures, and what we were interested in is a heart rate response, because heart rate is one of the indicators of the kind of physiological response to trauma reminders. So they saw, one category was general threat pictures, neutral pictures, and then they had trauma-related pictures for the accident survivors. It was pictures like this, and for the assault survivors, pictures like that. And what we then measured was their heart rate response to these pictures. And this is now just shown for the trauma-related pictures. We found a differentiation between people who later developed PTSD and those who didn't develop PTSD. The ones that developed PTSD showed a mild heart rate acceleration, whereas the people who didn't develop PTSD showed the usual pattern of an orienting response, which is reflected in a decrease in heart rate. And I should say here that people who participated in the study actually said that those images hadn't actually reminded them of that trauma. They were actually very dissimilar from that trauma. So even though it wasn't really like a good match to their own trauma, they responded to a wide range of these related pictures with a mild heart rate acceleration, at least relative to the other group. And again, this predicted PTSD at 6 months significantly in the study. So again, one can always find lots of problems with each study, but one piece of evidence for this, the idea that the generalization of a response, physiological response, may be related to PTSD in the long term. So how can we now use this for developing psychological treatments? One is, so I just recap the priming and also the generalization of these physiological responses and fear responses lead to the prediction that one of the problems in PTSD is that people poorly discriminate between what happened in the trauma and the reminders in everyday life in our encounter. And we therefore developed a specific technique that we call stimulus discrimination training, where first patients work with the therapist in great detail to identify their individually relevant triggers. And as you can imagine, that's quite a lot of detective work, because people only say, I have intrusions in loads of situations, so we have to find in the situation what is then common to them, or what are the different types of triggers. So that is an important piece of the work. But once we have found a trigger, like let's say the green color of the surgeon's coat, then we can help the patient learn to discriminate between what they saw then, the green coat, and what they saw now, the green bars. And we do that in the session, but also then outside the treatment session. And the patients learn whenever they have an intrusive memory or when they feel suddenly very threatened without knowing why, they observe the situation, try to find what the trigger could be, and then also quickly concentrate on all the differences in the situation that are different from the trauma, so that they can take in that the stimulus is no longer dangerous. So this takes some practice. A bit more now about this flashback-like feature. We talked about why are the triggers, why are so many triggers. Why do people with PTSD experience their memory as happening now? This is very different from usual experiences. You can have vivid memories of something that happened, let's say your last birthday or something like that, but usually people don't relive everything that they had then. And that's different in PTSD. So one hypothesis there is that basically what happens is in trauma, things happen very fast and are overwhelming. So the cognitive processing can't quite keep up with everything that people have to process. And we have talked about people really processing more the sensory elements of the situation rather than what it all means to them because of them being overwhelmed. So we call it data-driven processing. And the result of that is that the memory for the worst moments of the event is quite disjointed from other autobiographical information and not sufficiently elaborated. I need to fill that, I think, with an example. So the most typical example is actually quite striking and very common, that people, in most traumas, people, if the trauma affected themselves, were convinced they were going to die. But obviously they know now that they didn't die, and it's often years after the trauma that they come for treatment. But they still, every time they remember a particular threatening moment in the trauma, they will then re-experience this fear of dying, and often really feel they are dying again, even though they know that they didn't. So we call that kind of that memory, moment in memory, is quite disjointed from what they know now. And this is something we can then help them with in treatment. So because these moments are not elaborated and basically not linked to what happened afterwards or the final outcome of a situation or what we've learned since, is that the moment in memory stays basically as threatening as it did at the time. Each time it gets re-experienced, people feel the same again. And we have found some evidence for this idea of disjointedness. One was in a study where we asked people just to give a narrative of that trauma. And we just had a coding system for how disorganized or disjointed the moments that later were linked to intrusions were compared to other time points during the trauma. And you can see in the global rating, the one time point about the trauma is much more disjointed and muddled and disorganized. And interestingly, and we find that a lot in patients as well, 23% actually completely omitted the part that was related to the trauma from their narrative. We don't know whether they couldn't remember it or whether they just didn't want to tell us about it, but we have also seen this phenomenon quite often in patients, that actually when they're trying to remember the trauma, just telling a story, they often actually don't access those particularly important moments that are linked to the intrusive memories. So again, something that we can use in treatment. Skip this. And finally, we did an experimental study where we had people with had PTSD, these are the red bars here, and we had people who were traumatized, had the same type of trauma, but no PTSD. And we asked them to bring into mind the worst moment from the trauma or the worst moment from another negative event in their life that was matched for various characteristics. And when they had brought this to mind, we asked them to retrieve some autobiographical information from a standard autobiographical memory test where people get asked, like, what was the name of a primary school teacher or what street did you live in there? And our reasoning was that if the moments from in the trauma memory are disjointed from the other autobiographical information, it would take people longer to retrieve that autobiographical information when they are thinking of the worst moment in the trauma. And this was the case. There was a difference in the PTSD group and the no PTSD group. It took them much longer to retrieve other autobiographical information. So what have we learned for treatment about this? We've developed a special technique that we use in our treatment that we call updating trauma memories. And I should probably say here, it's not like rewriting the history. Obviously, we want to find information that is really makes the event less threatening, but it should be a true representation. So what we do is we ask work through with the patient to identify the worst moments of the trauma and the meanings that are attached to this. Like, for instance, I'm a bad father, or I'm going to be assaulted again. And then we identify information that updates the meanings and the impressions or predictions at the time. So in the most simple case, it is actually something they already know, like I didn't die, or I wasn't paralyzed, or I'm still living with my children if they thought they were going to never see their children again. But in other cases, it will be require more therapeutic work to come to a new view of the situation, like especially if people feel very guilty about the trauma or feel very ashamed about things they did or didn't do. It usually involves quite a detailed discussion with the therapist, looking at it from different angles and come to a more balanced, less threatening evaluation of the situation. So once we have found this updating information, we then bring the memory into people's mind again. People think about the worst moments that the bad meanings were about, and we bring in the updating information, which can be verbal reminders, It can be imagery or it can be behavior. So for instance, if somebody believes they were going to be paralyzed, it's more effective to actually make them walk up and down and really feel their body move when really bring that meaning of during the trauma into perspective. I'm going to now, I was a bit too ambitious. I'm going to now just take you through, I've given you two examples now where the work we've done, first understanding a bit more about the phenomenology of the disorder, then of doing experimental work and other work to identify factors that may contribute to developing specific therapeutic techniques that help address this problem. And then I would now like to talk a bit more about the treatment in general and the studies testing the treatment. So just to recap, we have talked about the idea that the basic problem in PTSD is that patients perceive a current threat, and obviously we would want to reduce that. And the model gives us then as a therapist particular goals that we need to, particular steps we need to take to treat PTSD. So we want to identify the appraisals and modify them. And we talked about the updating memories procedure, so that helps with that. We talked about elaborating the trauma memory in certain ways, so it also involves usually writing a whole narrative of a traumatic story. We talked about discriminating triggers, and both of these together would already decrease the current threat. But we would also work with patients quite extensively on any cognitive strategies or behaviors that they use to keep the threat at bay or to that keep the appraisals and memory problems going, to make sure that the treatment effects are long-lasting. So what do we know about the treatment? We know it works, it's acceptable to patients, and we have tried the treatment in trials and in routine clinical care in adults and children. And we've also found that it works for multiple trauma as well as single trauma. And interestingly, also as an early intervention for soon after the trauma, it can prevent long-term PTSD. Just want to give you the results from one trial as an example for how much more, how much better patients can get. So in this trial, we compared two different versions of the treatment between and that was the standard treatment, which is given over 12 weeks and is a weekly session with a therapist. We had another version of the treatment where we put the most of the treatment happened within 7 working days, so it's like a 1 week treatment. So all the steps, it didn't save therapist time, but it was from the patient. The treatment was much more condensed, and as you can see here, this is from between the initial assessment and 3 weeks later, the people who got the intensive treatment benefited quite a lot, and much more so than people in the standard treatment at that time. And in the final outcome, there was no difference. So the intensive treatment worked as well as the weekly treatment, and both of these treatments work better than a psychological control condition, an active control commonly used in many countries to help people after traumas, like supportive therapy. This is the green line here. You can see they also got better, but the difference was quite marked. So in terms of percentages of people who fully recovered, the cognitive therapy groups were around 73% to 77% fully recovered. In the supportive therapy group, it was 43%, which is quite good, but we can do better than that. And then there was also waitlist, and as you would expect in a chronic sample, you wouldn't see much improvement in the waitlist. So I guess this also takes me to something that we are currently quite interested in. We have found a treatment that works, but we also want to think about ways of delivering treatments that give patients more choice, such as, do you prefer to come once a week for 3 months, and or do you prefer to get the treatment all done, take a week of holiday if you're still in work, and get most of the treatment done in a week, and then have a few booster sessions afterwards. We can now give people that choice in our clinic. And so we are working further on this, and I come back to this in a minute. So we have found that the treatment works, but why does it work? This is another aspect of research that we are very interested in. We can have our ideas about what we do in treatment and why it helps, but this may not be true. So what we're quite busy doing at the moment is that we are looking at mediation analysis, where we look at those factors that we try to target in our treatment and whether they actually are responsible for the change in symptoms. And one method we're using there is growth curve analysis. And I've just given you one example here for where we looked at a measure of the cognitions. This is an example of the appraisals that people have, like I'm going to be assaulted again, or I'm a bad father, I'm a bad person, and the symptoms of PTSD. And if we are right in assuming that changing the appraisals is actually an active ingredient of our treatment, or is one of the mechanisms of treatment, then what we would expect is that we see a change in the cognitions first, and then the change in the cognitions predicts the change in PTSD symptoms. And as a test, we can try it the other way around. Maybe it is, you could say, a critical observer could say, well, this is what you believe, but in reality, it might be you have some kind of non-specific, maybe you are a very nice therapist and patients feel much safer with you, and then their symptoms go down. And then as a secondary to that, this cognitions change. So we wanted to put that to the test. And we had a sample treated at our London clinic. We had more or less complete data from 268 patients. And we had weekly measures of PTSD symptom scores, weekly measures of the appraisal scores, and then we used the statistical method of growth curve analysis to analyze it. That's probably too complicated a picture, but I will just briefly, this is what I just said. We have the measures every session for the PTSD symptoms. We have the measures every week for the cognition symptoms. And then statistically, you can calculate the intercept and slope for these two curves. And you can take out any variance the symptoms in session one will predict the symptoms in session two, and so on, and the cognitions predict the cognition in the next session. But what we are interested in is these kind of these crossover correlations here. So does a symptom change from session one to session two actually predict the symptoms over and above what you can predict from the symptoms and the slope in the symptoms? And this is what the result showed. So we could predict the symptom change, so PTS scores, from cognition changes in the previous session, and that was significant. We did the test the other way around, checking whether actually the change in cognition just follows the change in symptoms. That wasn't the case. That was very far from significant. So that's a kind of line of research we're quite interested in, and expanding this now to the memory factors as well that we are interested in, and the behaviors that I talked about. So what I've shown you a bit of data for today was that there is a experimental and support from prospective longitudinal studies for the various components of the model I talked about, and the PTSD treatment is effective and acceptable, and the mediation analysis that we've done so far support the role of cognitive change in driving symptom change, meaning that we are probably on the right track. But I also wanted to mention what we are currently interested in, how we want to take the work further. We are further interested in improving, first of all, patient choice, but also the efficiency of the delivery of the treatment. 12 sessions with a therapist is, you could say, maybe not much compared to other forms of psychotherapy, but still in quite resource-intensive kind of treating the problem. So we have been interested in whether we can get the same effect sizes in treatment if we deliver the treatment in slightly modified ways. We've just completed a study, although we haven't got the results yet, where we try to make the treatment much more efficient in terms of therapist times by developing self-study modules. So some of the routine elements in treatment can be, we thought, could be done by self-study, like, for instance, the demonstration that thought suppression actually backfires. We can do it with the therapist in the session, but we could also put it in a manual what they're meant to do and observe them their reaction at home on in their own time. And overall, the self-study modules basically allow us to halve the number of therapy sessions. And from what we know from supervision, it seems to work well, and we're hoping that it will show the same kind of effect sizes that the face-to-face therapy gets. And interestingly, we first thought, oh, people with PTSD can't concentrate and they have lots of problems. Kind of even concentrating in a session, are they going to be able to do this? And there's obviously always exceptions, but overall people were actually very positive and actually said something interesting. They said they felt they owned their progress more because it was like clearly more, it was their work when they had done the work on the self-study modules, and then with the help of the therapist then worked further on this. So they felt it was really more up to them that they got better. So after the positive experience with the self-study modules, we're now currently starting to work on trying to develop an internet-delivered version of the treatment, where we would still have therapist support, but even less so than in terms of time in the self-study modules, and patients would see lots parts of the treatment explained to them, but also shown to them in videos, and hopefully they will then be able to do quite a lot of the work themselves. But this is basically what we're doing in the future. We are also interested in more doing more research on the mechanisms of treatment effects. I talked about the mediation studies with the weekly questionnaires. I'm sorry to say I don't have the results yet. We have also done no neuroimaging studies where we are trying to look at changes before and after treatment and response to trauma reminders. So I hope to be able to report on that later this year. We're also interested in predicting PTSD and other health problems in emergency workers and other professionals who are routinely exposed to trauma. And we've just looked at initial data from a study in newly recruited ambulance workers, and found that some of the predictors that I talked about today, then also predict PTSD in prospectively, even before people are exposed to the trauma, which then hopefully will help us to design some prevention programs to help people in these professions be prepared better for coping with stress at work. And we are still very interested in continuing with the work on memory mechanisms in PTSD. I've given you a few examples here, but we are, for instance, one of my doctoral students is currently pursuing the idea whether there are differences in updating information and memory between people with PTSD and no PTSD. Maybe it's not specific to trauma, maybe that's a general characteristics of people who later develop PTSD that then might give us more ideas for additional interventions. Well, thank you very much for your attention, and I'm happy to answer questions if you have time.
Great. Okay.